Okay, so you guys are getting the picture here, right? There's several things. There's vanilla ice cream in the trunk with this. So you got Vanilla Sky. You've got Eyes Wide Shut. It's all in this interesting commercial. I just wanted to point that out to you guys. And there's broccoli in one of the bags as well. And I think that's a reference to George Bush Sr., believe it or not. But anyway.
Hey, was this in the same break as the Scientology commercial?
I didn't watch the Super Bowl, so I don't know. Wouldn't that be hilarious?
Yeah.
That would be awesome. But anyhow, so I wanted to talk to you guys now about this whole 55, 66, 77 thing, unless you guys have something else that you want to touch on.
I got to run outside just for maybe 50 seconds and do something. So I'll be
okay, back. Well, yeah, cool. Well, we'll just wrap without you. So how are you doing, Alan?
Oh, wow. Yo, I'm fine. Fine.
Yeah. You've been overworked?
Definitely overworked. I'm fucking I'm actually laying on my floor right now talking to you, trying to get off the fucking floor.
This is a good opportunity for me to talk about this very kind of trivial sort of sink I just had yesterday. There's a coffee shop down the street from where I live. I live in Portland, Oregon, and I just walked down the street, and I guess there's new ownership. And I walked in, and the people that own the place were there, kind of like discussing like their new modifications or whatever they're going to make. And I saw a guy reading a book, and it was the book, and I didn't know it at the time, but it's this book that you put out, Alan, the Astro Music thing.
Yeah.
I just saw it on the table, and this guy had it open to the Harmony of the Spheres. And I was like, oh, that looks interesting. I wonder what that is. And then I came back, and I started looking at the Sync website, and I said, wait, that's you. I was kind of blown away that this guy was just reading it right there down the street. And I don't know I know that guy Ezra lives here in Portland.
Correct, yeah.
I don't know if he's related to them somehow or what. But
oh, you live in Portland?
Yes, yes.
Oh, Portland.
Oh, is he related to them? Them who?
Oh, just like these people that had just bought this coffee shop or something.
Well, okay, so Ezra does live in Portland. He got his Astro Music into a bunch of bookstores in Portland.
Okay.
So it could be that people, and I know.
Yeah.
It could be that, you know, someone bought it, or it could be that Ezra does know them. I don't know. Yeah, there's a lot of people there. You got Ezra there. You got Steve Wilner. You got Patrick Speck.
Yeah.
I've
never met any of these people.
What? Any chance you're coming to Olympia in August?
That'd be fun. I haven't made any definite plans. I might be able to. That'd be cool.
Totally come, man.
Never been to Olympia, so yeah, that would be a lot of. I'll try.
I know, because I know a few people are going to be heading up. Might be a way to kind of.
Oh yeah, sure.
Carpool or whatever. I know Patrick's definitely coming. Ezra's definitely coming.
Cool. Yeah, maybe I'll get in touch with them. But anyway, that was my.
A lot of think heads in Portland, man.
I know, it's kind of crazy. I'm kind of a recluse, so I don't really get out much.
You guys
to
need
people.
To all hang out. You need to organize it. You got to get Bo and Steve and Patrick.
Oh yeah, Bo G. Bo G's there also. Awesome.
I will do that. Let's do that. All right.
Yeah.
All right, we're back.
But yeah, so that's a nice little plug. Astro Music is a new book from Sync Book Press.
Looked cool.
Yeah, it is. It's fucking awesome. thesyncbook.com/astromusic with a MUSIK.
We got some books coming out. You're working on my teacher's book.
I actually am supposed to Skype with him in 20 minutes, so.
Oh, okay.
Well, then let me lay out this theory for you before you have to go, Alan, because it's basically this whole 1955 to 1988 thing, which is represented in the Back to the Future films. Somebody recently posted on the kitchen sink. Or maybe it wasn't that, but it was something similar. A link to a short film called Back to the Futures, which analyzes the Back to the Future movies in terms of the economic crash.
That's Tim Murphy, who's also going to be in Olympia in August. He's also coming. Tim Murphy, he's been on 42 Minutes, and I've also watched that. It's about I think it's 42 minutes long, and
it's
really
a great
good.
Movie. It's really, really, really worth good. Looking at.
Yeah.
Really worth looking at. But here's the thing. So you have this bifurcation of the time stream that happens in 1955, right? And of course, Terrence McKenna talked about this, the bifurcation of the time stream. So I thought I'd throw his name in there to the mix because Alex is interested in McKenna too. So you have this idea coming up in McKenna at least.
Philip K. Dick too.
Yeah, and it's being represented very strongly in the Back to the Future movies as beginning at 1955. And it's interesting that there is a double stamp penny from 1955. It's a Lincoln double stamp penny. And it, two images of Lincoln actually appear on this penny. And of course, copper is representative of Venus. So I'm thinking that Venus is actually the point of the bifurcation of a time stream. Okay? So the main...
Venus, of course, making the pentagram in the sky, and so to have the 55 or the two pentagrams would be
yes,
the split. Yeah,
absolutely, yeah, totally. So, here's how it works. I spent a good deal of time meditating on this, and it just this morning while I was watching this Law and Order, it just kind of exploded into my head. Okay, first of all. And this relates to the idea of LaRouche and his concept that the sphere is the only natural state of existence and that all other forms of objects are expressible only within a larger circumscribing sphere, okay?
Right, because of the star tetrahedron, but yes.
Yes, yes, yes. So this is one of the things about the cubical world that creates problems is that there's very little access to the sphere. Because if you have a cube inside of a sphere, it only touches on eight points, all right? And that's the four corners of the cube. But it actually touches in nine because of the dead center portion of the cube, the exact zero point at the center of the cube where the center of the circle also resides. So you have a cube and then you have the sphere outside. Now, what that means is that, and I'm thinking to myself that, okay, so... This is a little bit weird, all right, but I'm currently of the belief that there is only a very small number of people in the world, and I'm thinking it's the cube of 64, which I believe is 3,994, and it's very interesting that the cube of 64 is that number because it's very close to 4,000, which would represent the cubical mem in the Judaic, because the only oblong cubical-shaped letter in the Hebrew alphabet is the letter mem, or meme, or mayim, or however you want to say it. So mayim actually represents the cube itself, right? So I think that, so we now have a 64 by 64 square, and I'm pretty sure that's 3,994. And that means that if it's true, now the reason that I think this is because this is what happened with the bifurcation of the time stream. It's actually more than just a bifurcation. Because and this is something that I've discussed with Alex, the number two automatically implies infinity. Because two creates a dialectic, and a dialectic creates an automatically necessary third point. That third point creates a triangle. That triangle then creates a tetrahedral shape. It happens automatically. Literally, out of the number two explodes infinity itself. It's just a fact. It just explodes right out of it. Even a conversation between two people is inevitably infinite in its nature because William Burroughs talked about this too, about the so-called, he called it the fourth presence. He noted that whenever he was with a group of three people, it always seemed like there were four there. And this goes back to Ernest Shackleton, who was one of the first men to try to go to the South Pole. And he traveled with two men in incredibly long-term, dangerous situations. And when the three of them actually got back to civilization barely alive, all of them were absolutely sure that there were four. They couldn't understand where the fourth person in the group had gone. And this is the truth, is that every number automatically implies a number after it. And a configuration after it. It's actually part of the group. So two, therefore, explodes into infinity.
Is this why in the gospel Jesus says, wherever two or more people are gathered in my name, I will be there? Because he's the third?
Amen. That's all I got to say to that is amen. And may he be with us now because we're gathered on the digital world. So may the digital Jesus bless us here. so anyway, and I say that in all seriousness. So you have then these eight points. And only eight points on a cube that actually touch the surface. Now, if the bifurcation of the time stream that supposedly happened at some point, which is part of the Valis idea, right? Because it has to loop back around itself. So it's not so much a bifurcation as it is a kind of a loop, right? With a slight overlap, like a piece of tape that you join with the sticky two sticky ends together, and you leave the rest open. Except that in a more technical way, those two ends would actually, it would just be clipped off, and there'd be a very small section where they overlapped. And like I was saying to you earlier, I think that is a 66-year period, and then the actual length would be a 70-year period. Okay, so my theory is this, is that the bifurcation of the time stream, it splits not only time, but all orders of reality underneath it. So that means it splits up space, it splits people, it splits everything. So ultimately now, after the bifurcation of the time stream, there are an infinite number of cubical worlds that can exist within a sphere. Because essentially the interior and exterior of a sphere is actually both an infinite number of corners, essentially. Like a sphere is just like a square with a hyper-infinite number of corners. So the cube itself, which I believe should be 64 by 64, and then roughly representing mem as well, there can only be 8 people, I think, actually people, at any given time that can conglomerate into a group together and create, actually be touching the exterior or the interior surface of the sphere. So actually being able to access the spherical knowledge. And I actually believe that in this, and there's, I watched this extraordinary video recently on Disclosed TV. I'll send you guys a link later, and I highly recommend that you take a look at it. But it basically professes the idea like that, and this is something that came up in the Mad Men issue recently, is that the world is actually filled with only a very small number of people, and that there are literally thousands upon thousands of actual groups of these people. And if you leave one of your groups, you go into another one, the person who represents you in that other group has to leave and come into yours. So it's always perfectly balanced. And that's the only way you can leave your group of people, is to temporarily go into another group of people who are different in their appearance, but who are going to end up representing the exact same kind of properties to you as your other group of people. So you're, in this sense, you can be anywhere, but you're always the same person in the same group of people. And that group of people is roughly 4,000, right? And the ineffable extra 6, I believe, represents the central point, because that 6, as we all know, represents phi, right? And it could also represent the spinning of this cube inside of its spherical space, fixed on a center point in the exact same way that a record album is fixed to an LP player, right? So there would be that center point would then become the 6, the solar center. So that gives you the 4,000 right there. So you've got 4,000 people, 3,994, and then the extra implied 6 would be that Christ presence that fixes the center, okay? Now, check this out. So what happens now is you have many, many of these cubes that can, there's any number, because there's no limit to the actual number that can be inside, right? The number of cubes. But I believe that each human being moves only within one cubicle group or can temporarily replace another person in a different cubicle group if a switch is taken place. And this gives you things like the so-called double life theory. The Double Life of Veronique is a really good film by the Polish filmmaker Krzysztof Kieślowski, and I recommend taking a look at it. But this idea of a Doppler and how there might be a moment in time while you were passing through from one to another where you might notice this person in just a split second, and that's the only chance of ever confronting them for very long. Now, so you're always moving from one of these cubes to another, and because they're represented in terms of time, you can also move from different points in your actual life, right? So you can find yourself suddenly at an earlier point of your life. You wouldn't even recognize it because, you know, when I was 14 years old, I didn't know the 48-year-old me. The 48-year-old me knows the 14-year-old, but if I went back to 14, I wouldn't remember anymore. And then I would progress in the exact same fashion through that particular cube to a point on the corner, because only Christ can represent the center of this thing. You may pass through Christ, but you cannot dwell there. So you go to one of the corners. And this kind of thing gives you the heavenly creatures concept, right? Which we see in two dimensions on the world card.
Oh, okay? You mean cherubim, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You have the four fixed astrological personalities, and they can, by hook or by crook, I'm not saying that only those individuals can go to those corners, although it actually might be true. that only a Leo, a Scorpio, an Aquarius, or a Taurus could actually meet, go all the way to these corners.
By Thoughty or the Crookes tube.
Yeah, exactly. So now what happens is this. Under the influence of the bifurcation of the stream, what you have is everything is now being turned inside out. Because turning over the hourglass ceases to be an exceptional point. Right, the repetition of turning over an hourglass when it empties to the other is too obvious. It's going to build a pattern that is too easy to recognize. It needs to be more sophisticated than that. So what it has to do is it has to turn itself inside out. Now, the planet Iapetus actually has two holes, one at each end. And around the center, it has a ridge that is many, many thousands of feet high. Okay, and this is, and it goes right along the equator. A mountain, essentially, a mountain ridge, a narrow mountain ridge, all the way around the equator of Iapetus. And then on the two poles, you have these two holes. They're actually holes. And near these holes are all this mineral deposits, right? And that's the sand from inside the hourglass. It now sticks by way of gravity to the outside of the hourglass by being turned inside out, which is what I think that Kubrick's doing. So, or showing us the process by which that takes place. So now what happens is that the cube within the sphere becomes a toroid. Because this is what happens when you turn a solid object inside out, is that it becomes an ever perpetually active toroid. So really, with inside the cube is hidden a hyperdimensional supersphere, essentially. And that would be Christ at its center again. And, of course, the toroid image is central to Christ. And if you I just, for the first time ever, saw the epic biblical film, The Greatest Story Ever Told. And the first image is of a toroid. And it shows Christ standing at the exact bottom of the toroid, which would be the Christ of the crucifixion, as represented by Dante as being a cross at the bottom of a sphere, which also gives us Venus.
Hey, so is this why in Chinatown, Polanski's line, right when he gives Jack the rosy nose, "I'll cut you like a fish," and his obsession with water relating to Mem?
Oh, yes, absolutely. The whole movie Chinatown is about water.
Knife in the water. You know, well, every fucking movie that Polanski does has this water theme.
Yes.
And then obviously his incident with the young girl was in the hot tub, you know, but that was what there was tripping out the judge, actually. I saw an interview with the judge in his case talking about how strange it was that he's like, "I went and I watched these films of this guy, and it's like everything he does has this obsession with losing of innocence in water." And you could take it that, you know, Jesus with the his water and the fish theme, "I'll make you fishers of men," fish.
That's right. It's, you know? It's an inverted baptism.
Interesting.
There's something about the visitor that I wanted to mention in relation to this that I don't know if you remember this, Mark, but the Shelley Winters character, who is the caretaker of this kind of demon child, there's a point at which she's singing the song, I can't remember the name of it. It's "Mommy's Gonna Buy You a Mockingbird." It's like the lullaby, but she says, "Mem's gonna buy you a mockingbird," and she says "Mem,"
yeah.
And I just thought of that and you know, connection.
When Mem shows up in 2001: A Space Odyssey with "Open the Pod Bay Doors," Hal, you can see it flashing on one of the screens.
Really,
it's supposed to be just these random letters, but then it's like "Mem," uh-huh. Really?
Well, there's another one. There's another one that's "Nuke," NUC. The word "nuke" is also it's a colony of insects that fly out. Erica pointed this out to me that I can't exactly, but it's a colony of insects that seems very cynical in a way. But it also relates to like there's a theme of like bees in like yellow. There's a yellow and black kind of striped theme in the film, like. And there's, of course, all the hexagons everywhere, which, of course, relates to Saturn, and a bee's hive is hexagonal.
Yeah, watch the first Star Trek. Star Trek Emotion Picture.
Alex, so is the question, you know, is just to play devil's advocate here, is it a comment on the colonialization of space? Like, is the colony invasive colony of insects is that humans going into outer space.
Yeah, that's what that would be my, right. my interpretation of it. Or sort of like the idea of these the humans, specifically these humans are being sent out as like drones, kind of.
Exactly,
like
yeah. Human
beings are insectile type. Worker bees or whatever, doing the bidding of the queen or the species, I guess.
That's very relatable too. You know, I have this sync up. I'm really stoked it's still up, at least for now, with Titanic and the downward spiral, which is absolutely fucking incredible, and I highly recommend checking it out. But I didn't realize when I put that together so long ago that, you know, that whole album was recorded over the spot where Sharon Tate was killed in her house in the Hollywood Hills. So on her right where she was murdered is where they set up all the equipment to record that album, which is I feel that it's more than reasonable to suggest that that's where the album got its name of the downward spiral is actually a reference to Helter Skelter, which is a downward spiral slide, which you go back to the top of for infinity, right? That's the idea. If you watch Titanic, you know, you have Rose and Jack. And there seems to be a subtext in the film that when you watch it with the album, it's very direct. You start the album on when Billy Zane slaps Rose is the first, you know, like you wait 1 second and then the hit. So it's like a hit and then there's a pause and then there's the next hit. And then like if you know the downward spiral well, you know what I'm talking about. But yeah, that's it's pretty incredible. And he actually took the door with him that Pig was written on, and that's why you have Hey Pig and March of the Pigs or whatever in that album is a reference most likely to the pig being written in blood on the door, which Trent Reznor took and made the door of Nothing Studios in Florida. He took the door with him when he left.
Wow.
Kind of crazy.
Wow.
Very interesting. And it's a monolith too.
Yeah, and that the fact that Jack is clinging to the door, which Rose survives on, and then he dies. It all ends with this door. Kind of interesting.
And you have to really ask yourself, like, what would be the incentive aside from a ritualistic? But even like what would be to actually say, I'm going to record this album on the spot of this murder. It's either to celebrate the murder or to try and, spiritually reverse the murder. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's, what would be the intention behind doing it?
Yeah, good question, right? And then Portrait of an American Family, Marilyn Manson's album that goes in sync with Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Marilyn Manson, goes in sync. So that album was also recorded in the exact same spot. In the same studio that was basically just the living room of Sharon Tate's house.
Very, very interesting. I need to look at your things. I'm gonna look at the Titanic one tonight, I think.
Hey guys, I'm gonna have to run here because I
got that call. Yeah.
I have to talk to David's rabbi, and I gotta get something ready before I talk to him.
That
just
is
a minute.
Too weird, man.
really,
to talk to David's rabbi. It's just. So it's like you're going to talk to God now. You're officially become Moses. You're leaving us, and you'll come back with a revelation.
I hope so. Good listening to you guys rap today, and
it was a pleasure getting to talk to you, Alan.
Yeah, we'll have to have you back sometime. I'd like to get more insight into what you've been doing. So.
Yeah.
So would I.
And exactly. I know the feeling. I know exactly what you mean.
Further in the tape, I came across another part that made me throw my headphones right off my head. I couldn't believe what I heard. Led Zeppelin's "Stairway to Heaven" again was voted the most popular tune of rock's history. Keep that in mind as I share this taped excerpt with you. Lyrics of the song, they sing the Piper is calling you to join him. She's buying her stairway to heaven. We know that's not possible. say that I've never heard of anything like that before. Probably not, but many, many people have. And this is what I'm talking about, and you're going to hear it in a few moments. They sing backwards in human voices.
Knife.
Yeah, so I don't know where you, what you guys think of all this, but that's quite kind of, that was my morning. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think it's pretty neat stuff, but what does it all mean? I don't know.
I wanted to mention to you, Mark, that, you know, we're talking about these Kubrick-Floyd connections. I have watched The Shining with Wish You Were Here over and over and over again. It's one of my favorites, so I have that connection.
How did you time it?
Well, I don't start it at the very beginning. I forget exactly, but I believe it's 15 seconds in after the Warner Brothers intro is when I start it. So basically, the way it has to hit is where, you know, when Danny's at the dartboard, right when it switches over. So that would be the beginning of the second side of the record.
That's the right place to do it.
Is well, I mean, that's the changeover. So when was it? Have a Cigar comes in is right when it switches to him at the dartboard, it's pretty mind blowing. And then I also have watched many times Full Metal Jacket with the wall.
Mm.
So
I've also done that. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Now you've picked the right point. This might be a good point for anybody who listens that wants to do the tensor, basically the nine movies. So the start times are always the same. You start the album at a certain point for each particular film. And for every film, it doesn't matter what album you're playing, you're always starting at the same time. So with 2001, and I'll give you my, like at the time that I did this first time up there in the Yukon that I explained to you, which was the single most life-changing event of my life. I talked about Alex about that in actual really visceral detail. It was destructive almost to the limit of actually taking my life. I nearly died in a 3 or 4 day period right around July 4th, 2001. Anyway, watching this, or at the moment, see, my friend who was talking about the the sync up with with The Wizard of Oz, you know, you have to start it on the third roar of the lion, right? Well, the lion doesn't roar on the MGM card in 2001.
True.
It's a very rare card. It's a very rare card. You don't see it too often.
Nope.
Where the lion doesn't roar. So I'm thinking, well, where should I start this? And I tried to, you know, I love classical music. And so I could not allow myself to have any music overplay the opening Also Sprach Zarathustra. I just wanted to hear it. I wanted to hear it, right? So I started the music exactly on the attack of the last note. And that's about 4 minutes and 23 seconds into a usual DVD of the film. The other two start exactly where you started your Shining sync up with Wish You Were Here. And that is exactly when placard, the Warner Brothers placard, fades away, right? The second that it's completely invisible, you start either Metal or Dark Side of the Moon or The Wall with The Shining. And obviously Metal being the predominant choice there. And then and I highly recommend, if you can, David, if you want to have your mind totally blown today, just do The Wall with Eyes Wide Shut, and it's the same way as with The Shining. You just wait for the Warner Brothers placard to disappear, mm-hmm. and you start The Wall. And what's interesting, I use the 1997 remastered version, by the way. And there are differences of up to about a quarter of a second. I've seen it with a couple of other, including the original album version, put onto tape. And it's very close to identical. But that's the version I use anyway, the 97 remastered version. So you're going to know right away. Because as you know, the beginning of In the Flesh, which, by the way, gives us the first image of Alice, right, standing there naked. There's that quiet section at the beginning of the song, right? It's just that little like accordion playing and somebody mumbling, right?
Well, he said, there's the We Come In. So yes. So the wall ends with This Is Where, We Come In. Yeah,
that's right. Yes. So you'll know you've got it exactly right because the moment that the striptease music of In the Flesh begins. Is exactly the moment that Alice appears on screen. If you start it when the placard fades out, it's exactly at it. And if you're not completely convinced by the end of the death scene with Marion, mm-hmm. When Dr. Bill goes to see Marion, and when he's to say goodbye to Lou Nathanson, if you're not completely convinced by then, you will be 20 or 30 seconds or 2 or 3 minutes later. I mean, it's just it's incredible. So take a look at it.
Sure.
So that's the way you do the tensor. You have those three albums, Metal, Dark Side of the Moon, and The Wall. And the starting times are on The Attack for 2001, which is 4 minutes and 23 seconds. The way that you can line that one up to know that you've got it exactly right with Dark Side of the Moon in 2001 is the very first time there is musical movement in the song is the exact time that the camera first moves. The first several images of 2001 after the opening sequence are all stable camera shots. There's no pan, there's no swish, nothing. And the moment the guitar starts playing is the exact movement the camera pans for the first time, panning upwards across the landscape in a, on the vertical.
For what it's worth, maybe it's the version of Dark Side that I have, but I modified it slightly that I started the album, like, right as the whole, it says says the title card, 2001, the last note is being held, and right as that fades out into black, that's when I started the album to get it exact, with the copy that I have. It might.
Okay, well, I think you should try it the other way.
Oh, I have.
Because if you do it right there, you will notice that the camera movement and the musical movement start at the exact same moment.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
If you do find that, like, obviously, the 4:23, like, I don't like to go by the time so much, but that obviously, at some point, I'm going to have to. But yeah, the 4:23 is meant to be a rough number. But yeah, just in that, there's a pocket, obviously, for each one where you want to get it exactly right.
Yeah.
And it's obviously not an exact number of seconds. It's usually like in between And I think this is somewhere between 423 and 424. So you're roughly in the right area.
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty much the same.
Yeah. You'll know that. But definitely check out The Wall right away. So you have the three albums, Metal, Dark Side of the Moon, The Wall. You have the three films, 2001, The Shining, and Eyes Wide Shut. Any one of these three albums with any one of these three films, starting at the times suggested, is what I call the tensor. And ultimately, the full tensor, the complete tensor, would be an in-depth study of all three films with all three albums, basically. Giving you the Magic Nine.
The Magic Nine.
Yeah, so I would recommend it for Shizzle. But anyway, that whole idea then about the time stream and everything, this is the world I think we're living in. Do you know what the Dunbar number is?
No, tell me.
Well, the Dunbar number is the actual number of people the most sophisticated human beings can manage relationships with at any given time.
Did you say Dunbar?
Yeah, Dunbar.
Like Stalag 17? What, are you going to go back to the commandant's office and tell him where Dunbar is? Dunbar is the one hiding in the water? Do you know what I'm talking about? Fascinating.
Well, that's really interesting. That is really interesting that you mentioned Stalag 17. Because today, I'm just thinking about all this stuff and about the cube being turned inside out, right? And obviously, the metaphor for cubism on two-dimensional is chess, right? But I began thinking about Go, okay? Which is obviously a superior game to chess in terms of its the ability to defy theory, right? Like, Go has no theory. The best Go theorists are still trying to, and this can be proven actually in terms of computers themselves, because right now, the best computer in the world can beat the best chess player in the world every single time.
Do you think that's still true for Go?
Oh, I know it's true. I know it's true.
Huh.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Oh, I know it's true. The big Deep Blue completely destroyed Garry Kasparov in a series of games, basically. And I feel that that point was finally proven with the Jeopardy thing where Watson played on Jeopardy. These logic systems are super advanced. But, and this is interesting in terms of the number 17.
They call them Watson?
Yes, Watson, yeah.
That's hilarious, sorry.
Bill, you should read my article, Quiz Show Holocaust, again.
Oh, no. No, I get it. Oh, that's fucked up. You're saying, is that because of Schindler's List, or is that just a happy coincidence because of Ralph Fiennes?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Seriously, it's that deep.
Interesting.
You know, my theory about Kubrick's failure to make the Aryan Papers is kind of interesting. You know he was obsessed with Hitler and Napoleon, right?
Of course, yeah.
Just like Charlie Chaplin.
Uh-huh.
Interestingly enough. And there's a Kubrick Charlie Chaplin reference in the Monolith episode of Mad Men that I just watched last night.
Really?
As well. It's blatant. It's really heavy-handed, basically, comparing Kubrick to Charles Chaplin. So anyhow, what was I talking about here exactly? what were we discussing?
Well, you were discussing Go initially, and you were saying...
Oh, yes, that's right. So you mentioned the Stalag 17 thing, and that reminded me of... So I'm thinking about chess in terms of the cube, and then turning the cube inside out, it becomes a little unwieldy, because obviously you have inside of each cube, if it's truly based on a kind of a limited number of people that can interrelate with each other, or a maximum limited number, then, you know, the 64 by 64 square, those are pretty big cubes. And when you turn that inside out, they're going to be enormous, right? Well, and then I'm thinking about it in comparison to the superiority of Go. So anyway, yes, of course, the current computers, chess is completely dialed down. I mean, chess players don't play computers anymore in competition because they can't beat them. It's done. They just play human beings now, and they use computers for analysis. The idea of human beings playing computers in chess is over. It is done. It's completely done. And you can ask any serious chess player about that, and you'll find out that that's true. However, it is not true with Go. And here's the difference, okay? It would take even an average chess program, right? Like the kind that you can buy in a so-called chess computer, an actual unit that has the computer built in where you can play chess right on it. They still sell those things. And they're rated around what 21 or 2200. 2000 is international master level. There's a mathematical formula they use. and 2000 is the master level. Most of these cheap computers you can buy for $100 are already at 2200. The world champion, the highest level ever achieved by a human, is 2800, okay? And that's by Garry Kasparov, all right? Around the 2800 mark. Computers can, the best computer can beat a 2800 player easily now. Okay, so that's not that spectacularly interesting, but here's what's interesting about Go. The most sophisticated computer cannot even beat an average Go player. Somebody like you or me, David, who understand the game and its rules. Computers cannot do it. They can't beat the humans.
So why is that?
Well, here's why I think it is. And this relates to the number 17. Okay, you know that the Go board is 19 by 19, right?
Yes.
Okay, well, the problem with all surface-related games, like two-dimensional board games, two-dimensional fields, is that they have these things called edges, right? And the battle, in a certain sense, becomes somewhat irrelevant around these edges, and it also becomes places where strength can be built in an unnatural kind of way. Like, if we're talking about chess as a spherical event, which would be something similar to global full-scale war, right, there are no edges to the board. So the edges of the artificiality of a chessboard, that's what makes it so simple. There's only 64 squares on there. But you have 19 by 19 grid with Go. Thing about it is it's always the edges that invalidate the game, right? And that's why, you know, you play from the corners,
yeah, you
build
play
out
four
from
corners.
The corners.
Yeah,
right.
Totally.
Yeah. Right. Well, but the thing of it is, so if you take away the edges of a Go game, it's 17 by 17. All right? Now 17 is a number that Kubrick uses repeatedly over and over.
Totally.
Heaven 17, for instance.
Oh yeah, no, I gotcha, yeah.
But here's the 17, heaven, implying some kind of limit. Okay? Now, because in Kubrick, we're talking about the audiovisual world, and I don't have the skills to do this, but if anybody out there who's interested in Kubrick who has really strong mathematical and plotting skills, I think there's something to this. Because in visual imagery, there are something called tile patterns, right? Like, for instance, the rug on upstairs outside room 237, that's a tile pattern, right? Where everywhere you look, it's the same. And yet it has this repeated, it's like a repetition. You can make these on wallpaper. You can use them for rugs, right? You know when you have a piece of wallpaper and it's like, it's a seemingly endless pattern with no seams?
Mm-hmm.
Are you following me here?
Yeah, mm-hmm. I am, yeah.
Yeah, it's the same with the carpet. It's the same with the carpet inside room 237 as well. Those are called tile patterns. And another tile pattern is the rug that's up behind the end of the hallway there in the lobby. That Jack stands in front of. You know, it's like the seal of Saturn, all the X's, right? That's a tile pattern too. And of course, tile patterns have their edges. That's where they don't work anymore. But the thing of it is that there's only 17 possible types of tile patterns. Mathematically, that's the limit, all right? So the number of actual patterns, patternistic, visual patterns, are limited to 17. There's only 17 possible types of visual patterns that exist anywhere. Mm-hmm. They can reproduce themselves on a visual field, on a two-dimensional field, period. And that also applies to three dimensions in ways that are too complicated for my mind to possibly wrap around, because I'm not really a mathematician. But I found that very interesting when I was researching the number 17, that this is the limit of tile patterns. And this seems very important to me in terms of Kubrick's one-point perspective, right?
Mm-hmm.
I believe there are tile mysteries hidden inside Kubrick. And ultimately, tile patterns are made by unfolding a cube, right? So that you have things connecting up on all sides. It's a way of not like a Mercator projection, for instance, right? Where you're unfolding a cube or you're unfolding or peeling an orange, basically, and then laying it flat so that all parts connect to each other,
uh-huh.
Okay? So I just think that that's very interesting in terms of both Go, which completely defies the computer world at 17 by 17.
Totally.
The number of patterns at 17, because you're removing the edges, which are necessarily artificial in order to play the game on a 2D surface, right?
Right.
So you've got your 17 by 17 on Go, and then you've got your 17 maximum number of tile patterns. And I think that's very interesting. I know, and of course, tiling is innate to the concept of masonry.
Sure, yeah. I was going to say that they found the same... The way I have heard it is not with tile patterns, but with bricklaying.
Yes, bricklaying works the same way. If you're laying mosaic patterns, if you're doing tiles like in on a bathroom wall,
right?
There's only 17 different tiles. You can mix up the colors or things like that as much as you want.
Right.
But the actual visual patterns, there's only 17 kinds.
Right. So speaking of one-point perspectives, I put a link just to the classic, iconic Abbey Road photo. And if you'll notice, if you look at it, that's a one-point perspective. The zebra crossing that they're walking across is actually six straight lines, which you can see could be representative of the heaven hexagram in the I Ching, which is very relatable to what we're talking about, because you say heaven 17, yeah, and you're relating it. Yeah, so I noticed that at one point, because it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, all good children go to heaven, which if you play it with Eye of the Devil, starting from Sharon Tate's title card, like where her title comes up, and mm-hmm. it says Sharon Tate, and you start it, and come together, you know, you have that line, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, comes in right when she's getting whipped. I don't know.
You've nice. Seen,
yeah, so
it's, that's one of my favorite films, by the way, Eye of the Devil.
So,
is that still up there?
What's that? My film?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I'm going to look at it.
Where was I going with that? I was going to say something interesting. Oh, yeah, so, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, All Good Children Go to Heaven was what was written on the door of the Manson family house.
Right.
But before Abbey Road was released. And so then that became a question, if he was hanging out with Paul, which is supposedly true, but that not only was he hanging out, but he apparently they took the lyric from Charles Manson, or Charles Manson got it from them. One way or the other, it's very suspicious.
Hey, can I interject?
Absolutely.
Okay, so I can't be exactly sure where you guys are going with this entire conversation, because I'm only just jumping in again.
We don't know where we're going with this conversation.
Okay, good. So then this will fit in perfectly. So first thing, you're comparing Go with chess. Computers can play chess, but they can't play Go. And your reasoning is interesting. I'll have to look more into that. But the way I understand that situation is, and you just put Penrose, I was literally just going to bring up Penrose tiling, so we must have some kind of like psychic connection going on. But the thing with Go is that it requires value judgments. And there's a level to cognition and a level to the way the brain operates, according to some people, including Roger Penrose, where it goes beyond binary computation. It goes beyond ones and zeros. Computers can't handle that. So he always made the argument that humans are not computers, which I tend to agree with. We have computational aspects to ourselves, but we are not. Yes. We're not robots. I mean, I think that's a rather truncated perspective to see humans in. So Go itself, in a sense, it's tapping into a part of the human experience, the human brain, the human thought patterns, the collective unconscious, whatever you want to talk about it as, that it reflects something transcendent about ourselves. So we can handle Go, but a computer cannot, because humans are special. And also, so that reflects one non-computational thing that humans can do. Another is these Penrose tilings. There's a mathematical practice called tiling the plane, where it's kind of like a puzzle. And they've run into certain issues where they can't tile the plane. And it becomes an uncomputational problem, except when you use these things called Penrose tilings. But these Penrose tilings are arrived at not through, again, they're not arrived at through formal mathematical linear equations. They're arrived at through largely value judgments and logical arguments that mathematicians agree on. So again, we're tapping into this higher level qualia of the human mind that I think taps into or explains human consciousness, and also helps explain what we're seeing in synchronicity, the acausal nature of it, the, you know, mass connections that are going on. We already know from quantum physics that reality is inherently non-local. This was proven by John Bell in the 60s. It's been going, we've known this for 50 years, but we're still operating under a paradigm that is Newtonian and local. So we are stuck in this Newtonian binary state of mind that ultimately leads to a lot of the problems that we're facing. And so I know you were talking how Kubrick, yeah, he might be an asshole in a lot of ways, but if this is really the stuff that he's putting into his work, if it's conscious, it could just very well be unconscious. I think it's pointing in that direction. fair enough. But I think we all agree that at times there's stuff that just seeps into our artwork that is we never planned for. I mean, I don't think you can plan everything. I think that's overstepping
That's an interesting question. I mean, if you can't plan everything, in my opinion, then we wouldn't be here, because reality itself, and this is the one thing that they rarely talk about in science, except when you get people talking about non-local phenomenon. And of course, that's still called woo-woo by a lot of people. The fact of the matter is that I have no idea what I was talking about now.
I have a question for you, Mark.
That's the fact of the matter. I have no idea.
I've had a question for a while looking at your Moon in the Middle ideas concerning determinism and free will. And mm-hmm. when you talk about the moon and you talk about its sphere of influence in terms of the tides and that we're made of water and these kind of ideas, do you actually feel that our lives are and the way that things play out in general are a where's the line between determinism and influence? Because my understanding of astrology, as the way I've read it in the text that I look at in Kabbalah, is it's always emphasized that we're talking about an influence and that we're not dictated by these things, but the amount of influence is very heavy, which definitely corresponds to my understanding of what has been uncovered in psychoanalysis. What are your thoughts on that?
That's a really good question, and I mean, it's the key question of existentialism, which is right at the center of cynicism too, as well as you mentioned with Kubrick. Before I try to answer that, I just want to say to John, to kind of bring it up to date in regards to the Penrose tiling and stuff, and not being able to use strictly algorithmic is really the correct term, right? Because you have an X, Y, and a Z axis, right?
Right.
Not being able to map things on an X, Y, or a Z axis inevitably become spherical. And this is one of the things that Lyndon LaRouche that I was talking about earlier was on. And what I mentioned while you were gone, John, is that I think that subsequent to 2001, to the events of 9/11, time became a property, basically. It is an actual measurable property right now in a codified way, as opposed to what we previously considered to be a representative way. Do you know what I mean? Like, for instance, you know, the day divides up, the world is round, it's 60 seconds, it's like the number of degrees in a circle divided by 6 for simplicity, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and that sort of thing. So what happens is that we have all of these ideas that are internally representative. They just represent only two other things inside the system itself. Mm-hmm. And what I think happens is when we make the leap that I believe we've made because of what I believe is the turning inside out of reality, what we have now is time is an actual material substance. And that's why that's what I believe it allows for these seemingly acausal, so-called synchronistic events, because so-called, well, that's a little bit touchy, but it's because literally we're not living in a linear time anymore. We are now living in blanket time. Right? Like there's just this massive piece of fabric, and any point of it can be folded over to touch any other point now, which previously couldn't be done. And this also has to do, again, with something we talked about while you were gone, I think, which was the bifurcation of the time stream and how reality, I believe, has split up into an infinite number. Well, not an infinite, ultimately. At this point, I suppose it would be, what is it, thousands? We would be looking at about 2 million different cubical realities existing in the world right now to give us the population of the world that we have at the current time. Because I'm suggesting that human beings have to be the nodal points inside of a reality. Even Einstein was tempted by the belief that truth is a human property. And I actually believe this, and that kind of goes with what you're talking about computers not being able to assess something that is true, Ultimately, right. They can assess things that are strictly logical, strictly cybernetic, yeah. Up or down, left or right, always. It's always two choices, left or right, up or down, and or combinations thereof. But ultimately, that is, you know, a series of steps. It is not a curvature. It's not the arc of the mythical diver, so to speak. So that's how I feel about it, is that we have these cubical realms that exist. and we live in a shattered world in which there's only a few thousand people. What I was saying earlier is that there's 4,000 essentially, and that access to spherical ideas is available because of the very nature of geometry. Out of 4,000 people, only 8 humans in any given group can discuss these things or can access the spherical realm at any given time, because the corners of a cube are the only parts of the cube that would touch the interior of the sphere, basically, which is why we have such small numbers of people. And percentage-wise, I think that's about right. You know, that's about basically 1 in 200 people. And go ahead.
I'm sure you've read the exegesis, or at least
I haven't actually, but no, I haven't. But I've looked at it.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I haven't even read the whole thing. I've read a few hundred pages, but it's so long and
it's hard to read.
It's hard to read, man. But anyway, Dick gets into this idea of free will, determinism, the coexisting of the two, and also overlaps that with these sorts of ideas that you're talking about, this kind of cubic reality. And I focused on this in my work too, where I'm interested in kind of the structure of space and what is the space-time continuum, what is it at root level. And there seems to be a fluid component, a fluid flowing component, but also kind of a lattical, rigid, cubic component. And Dick saw this as well in his visions. He said he came back, Alan kind of had this experience. A lot of folks have had this experience where they go into the idea space, psychedelic realm, whatever, and they come back with a sense of this kind of lattice work at the root level of nature. And so we are, and this even got into, we watched that movie, The Cube, from Jim Henson, and we talked about this a lot too in a past episode. But what we have is this cubic reality with flows going through it. And Dick, the way he argued it was that determinism is flowing from that box. You know what you've heard, you know, oh, we're stuck in a box, so we're stuck in this kind of rigid way of thinking. And determinism flows from that geometry. But at the moment when that kind of signal gets to us, where it's like, okay, here's a destiny point, this bifurcation point, this chaos tipping point, then our consciousness, our free will enters the equation, and then we can make choices from that point. But in a sense, we're being pushed and pulled by deterministic forces, but that doesn't mean that we are predetermined or that we have no control over our destiny. So we're active participants in that process. And that was his basic argument, was that
what I believe is that, like, and again, we can break out of the cubical but not the spherical reality because it's too big. And the idea of Dick's, that interesting idea that it's flowing through this cube, I mean, essentially it's a tape, right? If you think about just, and this is the exact thing, going back to Lyndon LaRouche again, this is the thing that LaRouche absolutely spoke against as strongly as he possibly could, was the idea that lattice frameworks are actually valid ways of examining scientific phenomena, because they're not, right? All they can do is provide this cybernetic thing, and then there's this massive area outside of that that they cannot ever touch, except in the corner points, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of a corner point and whatnot becomes really interesting. It's just in terms of Freemasonry and all of that other stuff, right?
And real quick, what is a tape other than its magnetic imprints on a strip?
It doesn't even have to actually be a tape. A tape's a nice way of actually visualizing it.
Right, so when you think of space-time, it's like, you know, information is embedded in space-time, and those could be just like magnetic lines of force in a specific pattern. So
there's a lot of ways of thinking about it. I believe that the cubical reality is completely false, or that it is illusory, that is actually the veil of Isis within the cube. When you are within the cube, you cannot see beyond the veil of Isis, essentially, at all, unless you're at one of those quarter points in which you become one of the cherubim, basically, one of the four, and ultimately in three dimensions, it becomes the eight characters who surround the world tarot card. At the end, there's the bull, there's the eagle, there's the human being, and there's the lion. Those are the four corner points from which an actual perspective of what is beyond the veil of Isis exists.
Wow, I've never related the cherubim to the go board before, but that's interesting.
Mm. Yeah, you could probably apply some pretty interesting theory there as well.
Yeah.
I'm sure that there's some strategies to be examined there. And that's quite fascinating too. I mean, Go apparently is astrological. And if we're getting in top to the idea of the so-called holographic universe, I don't particularly like that term for all sorts of reasons, but because it implies only the visual side of things, which is literally, I think, the smallest part. But nevertheless, the idea of the holographic universe being projected in such a way from four different, like, it would have to have, if you were projecting it, like, say, strictly from a two-dimensional space, you'd have to have at least four projectors, right? And then to get a three-dimensional, what appeared to be a three-dimensional image. And I believe that once you go into 3D with the eight different projectors, this is where you get the concept or the idea of an actual fleshy being, something that can be physically felt. And within that lattice framework, all you have the tape that slides in and out and around these areas. And because it exists and is implied by the greater sphere, there's all these clues all over the place. And they don't seem to mean anything at all. Nothing. But when you get one of these corner points of a perspective, then you can do it. And then possibly if you can get together with at least, you know, four or seven other people, then, or three or seven other people, then you can have what might even be something, if you can get to enough point of discussion where the perspective of others who have reached the corner is valid, you might actually be able to have between those groups of people a projected matrix themselves, essentially, which is kind of hinted at in all sorts of other works too. I think that Minority Report hints at that, even though there's only the three of them, to give you a two-dimensional. And the characters' names are A, D, and D, right? Which gives you analog, digital, and digital. Or is it analog, analog, digital? That's what it is. The characters are Agatha, Arthur, and I can't remember the D character. But so that gives you two analog and one digital to make a two-dimensional framework, something similar to, say, a recording like a movie. And then once you went into a full four dimensions, you'd have to have eight different perspectives. But you can kind of see what I'm getting at about that. But I don't know if you guys looked at that link that I just sent about Flat Stanley. There's actually a children's book called, oh my goodness, his name is Stanley Lamb Chop. You like Lamb Doc? And by the way, that line, you like Lamb Doc, that's not what he's saying. He's actually saying you like Lambda.
Oh, Lambda, Lambda, yeah. Lambda, and the Omega Moves.
That's correct. You like Lambda. And who would be more of a nerd than no. But the thing of it is, take a look. Just take a look at a lowercase lambda on Google Images. Just look it up.
Uh-huh. I got it in my head, yeah.
Okay, you know what that looks like because you're a Kabbalist, so that's natural. Wow. But look at a very you want to find one that's not stylistic. No serif. Sans serif, right? So there'd be no curls at the ends of the one line there. I'm trying to find a sans serif one. They're out there. Essentially, a sans serif lambda would be the A shape in the letter A, and then the right-hand branch of the A would extend upwards beyond the top of the A frame, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it would just be longer, like a T tipped sideways, right?
Mm-hmm.
Are you following me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm just going to find this link here. I'll send this to you. This should interest you. And I can count on good old Rob Badger for this. I'm telling you. Just type in overturned chair, The Shining, into the images. I'm sure Adger has got a very carefully labeled, yes, he does. Okay, there you go. Now, if you look at the image of the overturned chair, which I'm sure you guys are maybe doing, I don't know. You're doing it right now. Oh, actually, I'm looking at it. The very first one that comes up, if you type in overturned chair, The Shining, with John Paul Ryan, actually.
Oh, yeah.
So if you take a look at the image on the left-hand side, you see the famous overturned chair of The Shining. But really what it is, it's a double lambda, right? Can you see that? The forward edge of the chair, you see only the outer leg, right?
Hey,
so the forward edge of the chair, you have a lambda, a lowercase lambda. And then the far edge, the far side of the chair that's away from the camera is another lambda. So that's a double L.
Could you send us a link to the chair?
Yeah, I'll do it right now. I'm just trying to get to the actual site itself. There we go.
I just sent a link there.
Oh, okay. Did you? Okay, great. Thank you. I'm really bad at that sort of thing. No excuse, I guess. So if you guys take a look at it right now, you'll see that on the right hand of the screen, you have two lambdas, essentially. The front side of the chair, the one that's closest to the viewer, is a lambda. It's a lowercase lambda. And then the implication of the other lambda is behind it on the other side of the chair. You see that?
Do you know about the film, Mark, Knife in the Chair? The 13th chair? Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. Okay, there we go. It took a while to load. Interesting.
That's the meaning of it. It's a double L. It's an LL. There's LL clues all over Cooper.
So you know about, Lamed Lamed, Lilith, that's what I take that as, first off, that's LLLLL, because that's the way that Kabbalists abbreviate Lilith, because you're not supposed to say her name, so they always represent her name as two L's. So when I'm reading certain texts from certain rabbis, they'll often just have two Lameds. And if you didn't know that Lilith was represented by two Lameds, you'd be like, what the hell are they talking about?
Right.
But she's referred to as the Northern One. And so I look at I keep coming across all these references that seemed like it's only a Northern song. Sharon Tate's character in Valley of the Dolls is Jennifer North. There's just repeated correspondences that keep showing up of North relating to that. And so obviously, you know, I have this whole thing with Full Metal Jacket being about the Kleepote, that's the meaning of Full Metal Jacket.
Absolutely.
Literally. Yep. And so when the posters that went up and said in Vietnam, the wind doesn't blow, it sucks, because yes, she's a succubus. So it's very relatable in that way.
Very interesting. Well, you know, in one of my conversations with Alex, I was talking about a phenomenon called rip rap. Have you guys ever heard of this? Rip rap?
No.
Okay. It's rap with an with a W. Could be rip warp too, which makes even more sense, quite frankly. But it's called rip rap. Now, this is a phenomenon that happens during the construction of bridges, okay? Which leads into Scientology in a big way, too. As we discussed earlier, you weren't there for that part, John, but we were talking about the whole Scientology implication in Kubrick. Anyway, so with riprap, it's a phenomenon where this is what happens, okay? It would seem obvious to you, if you're building a bridge, that there is going to be over a river, by the way, that's important. That if you're building a bridge over a river, there is going to be constant pressure from the upstream side on the bridge, right? The water is constantly flowing from the upstream side and eroding the bridge. It's eroding the foundations constantly. And the next time you cross a bridge that's over a river, if you look, you will see that they actually put a large trail of rocks underneath the water. If the water's shallow enough, you can always see it. But if it's not shallow enough, it's still there. There's a large boulders that are placed in front of every one of the foundational supports on the bridge in the water to push the water further out around so that it doesn't erode the bridge, okay? But what they didn't realize was it actually happens on the other side too. There is something about the negative space created by the bridge supports that creates a vacuum. It's an actual it's a hydro vacuum process, because the water flowing one way also flows backwards in the exact spot on the other side of the bridge supports, eroding them there. So if you block it on one side, it erodes it on the other side. And this phenomenon is called riprap. Okay? Now, this is quite some time ago, I was thinking about this in terms of Kubrick, because what happened to me was I'm just trying to imagine the phenomenon of a toroid shape, right? Just a top-down toroid. So it's not open at the bottom. It's like essentially an orange. You're peeling it from the top. All right, so what you have here is a negative. This is what Kubrick means when he says the wind doesn't blow. It sucks. This is what happens in riprap, is that there's an actual, it turns it around. There's a moment in time where that water is moving neither forwards nor backwards, creating a little vacuum which can cause erosion, okay? Like a little wheel turning on the upstream side of the river. This is the planet Jupiter. This is what the eye is. It's three-dimensional riprap. And this is, it's time, basically. Jupiter is a time machine. And it has created a little suck, essentially, at the top of the toroid, right? And that suck draws everything that would normally just create a complete sphere back down inside to the toroid loop. And I've already explained to you guys how the toroid is actually just the cube turned inside out, right? It's essentially a false system, also relating to Jehovah being the designer of the toroid by way of the research of Stan Tennant as well, another Stan, basically. So, who identifies the fact that the encoding of the Book of Genesis encodes a toroid shape or a cubical shape, ultimately. So the toroid itself is actually just another cube, just a version of the cube turned inside out. So this is how this time loop is created, basically. In three dimensions, the tape goes out to a certain point, but linear time can't continue forward, and it gets sucked back, just like in riprap, because there's an obstruction, right? And that obstruction is represented by the foundational pillars of a bridge in water, but it's also represented by something on the surface of a naturally spherical thing that creates a suck. Now, here's what's interesting. Okay, like a sinkhole, for lack of a better word. Okay, here's what's really interesting this is going to get you. Just give me a second to remember this here. Okay, I forgot. So come back to me. No, just go ahead and rap for a second here, and I'll think about this.
Rip.
Yeah, no, I'm just trying to remember exactly how this works, because this is pretty neat. Okay, let me think. I can't remember. It just slipped my mind. But it'll come to me if we continue. Somebody throw something down in here.
Ooh.
Speak, people.
It's okay. A little silence never hurt anybody.
It's true.
Fair enough. But you can see how this works as a warp, a time warp, too, right? That's essentially what it does, is it creates a space that magnetically turns time back on itself. And Gick talks about this in his exegesis. Now, I haven't read this in years, because the only part of the exegesis that I read was back before it was published, and it was online. And it was the PKD Foundation, and they scanned all of his pages and put in. Of course, it was even more difficult to read completely unedited, because it's a total mess, and there's lots of notes in the margins, right? Well, I'm reading along in the margins, and he talks about, of course, the Valis loop. And he's referring to it, he says, it's like the Jewish alchemists, and that's the actual phrase he used. The Jewish alchemists created a way to turn time back in on itself. And that's what this is, essentially. It is a perpetual forestalling, or a bringing of Christ as the central unifying figure of a so-called kingdom of heaven. From the bottom, where he exists, he becomes a magnetic pole, and he's forced to the bottom. I call this the hangman's loophole, by the way, because what they do, in essence, is they make the world an immortal place. Every human being becomes immortal under Valis. We all live over and over and over again under amnesia. And Nietzsche, the philosopher, talked about this too, believe it or not. He described the exact same system when talking about rock walking around the lake. You'd be walking around a lake, and you just think you were walking around the lake. But every once in a while, you would come across an artifact that would suddenly remind you, a moment of deja vu, where you would suddenly realize you'd walked around it before. Then you would immediately forget again and quit. And this is kind of the anamnesis that I think Dick is talking about, described as a loop, a toroid loop. Every loop is a toroid. A walk around a lake is a toroid, right? And so this idea of loops and spheres being different than each other is something that's alien to most people's minds. The idea that loop is actually something that can be created digitally, right? So it's not really spherical. It's not even circular in that sense. Instead, it's actually cubical, because it's based upon up, down, left, right, up, down, left, right. It just doesn't seem that way. So what you have inside the sphere then is every human being becomes an initiated toroid at some point. Right, so they now move within a cybernetic world that they believe actually has, an eternal or a non-eternal quality. But in fact, they're living inside a non-cybernetic world in which they're totally eternal, but they just forget it because they're turning corners. When you're inside a sphere with no obstructions, you can see everywhere, but when you're inside a cube, you have to turn corners. You cannot see what's around the corner.
Do you have to turn black keys?
That's right. You have to turn black keys, exactly. You got to go around corners. So to understand, to see the world inside the Masonic mystery, cubicle, and of course, cornerstone, Freemasonry, all that stuff, it just goes on forever. And I wanted to tell you guys an interesting pun that I came across recently. And you mentioned this earlier too, David, when you were talking about reading that script and about the dogs and how there's apparently some kind of canine. Right? You use the word canine, okay? Now, I'm sure you guys are familiar with the phrase "son of a widow."
Mm-hmm.
Anybody there who doesn't know it? Okay, so for anybody...
I don't either.
Okay. Well, that's a phrase used by me. As a matter of fact, it's kind of a catch-all phrase to free yourself or to identify yourself as a... as a at least a third degree Freemason. You're a son
still
of
getting Lord. a lot of scratching.
Yeah, it's
oh, you know
Mark's
what?
I took, headphones.
Sorry, I'll fix it. Here we go.
That's better.
Sorry about that, guys. So you have this Freemasonry thing where they identify themselves as sons of the widow or May sons, mother's sons, Ma sons, right? So it's a bit tricky in that regard. It's a because is it really a mother? We don't necessarily know who the so-called widow is. But here's the thing. So you were talking about canine and the whole dog star thing. Well, I've talked to you before, at least to David and Alan and Bill, about Bill Schnieblin. Are you familiar with Bill Schnieblin?
No.
Okay. He's one of those so-called, I was once a part of a high-ranking Illuminati cult, but I was saved by the Lord types.
Uh-huh.
Right? And yes, exactly. Canine is 11-9. Exactly. So this guy, Bill Schnieblin, there's a thing. There's
Hold on 1 second. So you know then that 9 plus 11 is, what is that, 20?
20.
So I'm thinking of the next thing I'm going to say before I'm finishing the technicalities. So 20 is the value of the judgment card in tarot, which corresponds to, Shin, which literally means canine tooth.
Interesting. Oh, Sheen. Yeah, of course. Yeah. Wow. I always say Sheen, but yeah, Shin is the other way. Okay. I'm sending you guys a link to Bill Schnieblin's Prophecy Club lecture, where he talks about how he was a super high ranking Freemason, and he found the Lord. Now, this guy sounds like a total wackadoodle when he's talking, right? So I'm not asking you to necessarily believe what he's saying in the sense of his personality. It all sounds like a scam to me, right, when he's talking. But what's interesting is that he begins by talking about how once you reach a certain level in Freemasonry, you have to choose between the vampire path and the werewolf path. And he also says that this fits into the whole Underworld series and all that other stuff, right? But here's what's interesting. Okay, so and also he also mentions in his lecture, which is a much wash, even though the guy's totally whack-a-mole, like I should talk, so he talks about these two things and how you have to make the choice between werewolf or vampire. But most people choose vampire, almost everybody, because werewolf is much, much, much too painful, apparently. The process is too painful. Now, there's a movie called K-19, The Widowmaker.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're talking about time travel, right? K-19, The Widowmaker is a Harrison Ford film about a nuclear submarine incident. Nuclear, of course, just brings all that into it even more, all right? So, and it's very interesting about this film, K-19, The Widowmaker, which is actually a really exciting action film. It did horrible box office because of the name. People hated the title, and they ultimately blamed the title for the fact that it failed. Well, why didn't they change the title after test marketing? Well, here's why. K-19, The Widowmaker.
Teen Wolf.
Right? And then you have The Widowmaker right in there. With that added to give you the Freemasonic perspective. And of course, Michael J. Fox is the Teen Wolf, the kid who travels from 1988 to 1955
right,
and splits the time.
With his 42 yeah. jersey and Teen Wolf.
That's exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's quite an interesting little thing there. K-19, The Widowmaker. If I had any skills with Photoshop, I'd make a poster of Teen Wolf, but call it K-19. And I would write it out, K-19, The Widowmaker, and see if anybody got it. But anyway, so I thought you might find that interesting.
Yeah, totally. That's a good one. Yeah.
Well, we're coming up on the magical 4-hour mark here, guys.
Yeah. This is standard procedure for having a conversation with Mark LeClaire that we end up past the 4-hour mark.
Always an epic.
I've had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure if I have anything to say to you guys today. Honestly, all night long, I was just laying in bed, kind of lightly tossing and turning, thinking, I'm probably going to be completely at a loss.
Well, you had
and then this,
more to say than I think anybody I've ever met did in such a span of time. So it's kind of
ironic.
You know,
I never talked to anyone else, right? Like, uh-huh. until the next time I have a conversation on Skype, I will speak to no one. Uh-huh. I'll say hello to my mom. She doesn't like it when I talk. Well, she just wants me to keep my mouth shut. So that's pretty much the way it is. You know, I never talk about any of this stuff at all with anyone, except, interestingly enough, my psychiatrist and then you guys.
All right. All right.
Fair. And I wanted to point this out because the day that you contacted me for this was the day of my last appointment with my psychiatrist. Interestingly enough, I see him only monthly, once a month, and only for half an hour. So I get 30 and 30 there as well. But I never talked to him about my personal life. I talked to him about this stuff because I see him. And I actually said this at the last conference. I tell people that I'm there for him. Right, uh-huh. I'm there to help him see the light, and also to receive a prescription for a recreational antipsychotic.
Right,
which are really good when you want to sleep for like 3 days, which is what I'm going to do when this conversation is over. So anyway, it's going to be 25 ounces of gin and 300 milligrams of Seroquel. Look it up. Anyway, so. Something happened. Like, I've been trying to get to this guy. By the way, he's a shapeshifter, right? This, I'm not saying that literally. He's a blonde-haired, blue-eyed British guy, okay? So he's David Icke's perfect model for the And all I ever do is talk about this stuff with him. I jam as much as I can into a half an hour. And it's my stand-up comedy set that I do for him, right? So I'm always making jokes. I continually say, you're a Freemason. He goes, you're not. No, I'm not. And I say, well, that's exactly what you would say if you were a Freemason, right. And that sort of thing, and just that sort of bullshit. And I joke around, but mostly it's about the details of the kind that I'm talking about with you guys now, as much as I can get in to try and reach him, right, in some way to try and get him to see what it is that I'm seeing that I have been declared officially crazy for, right? I mean, in Canada, I am legally officially crazy. I've been declared severely mentally ill. So, and it's great because I don't have to work. So, So anyway, I never get through to this guy, never. And he is so professional in his manner. He's a strict Freudian in regards to the discussion, right? He never says a word. He never gives me any indication of what he thinks of what I say. He'll go, that's interesting, or that's amusing maybe. And then he calls what I do delusions of reference. And that's what he would say to you guys too. You guys have delusions of reference. It doesn't mean anything. You're just seeing the way things relate together and you're making a big deal out of it. That's what that's how he describes this type of a discussion that we're having. You would all fall under that banner as far as he's concerned. And I've never been able to get through to this guy. Hmm. And this time and I've talked to him about everything, about 911, which is so obviously a great big mystery play as opposed to what we're told it is and stuff like that. Everything you can think of regarding DeSync, that I can get in.
Hey, you should show him Kirby Surprise's book on synchronicity.
Okay.
Because I would take note of that and hand him a copy.
Well, he's read Moon in the Middle. He didn't actually read the whole thing, though. I know he didn't. Because I put things in there especially for him, and he didn't notice them.
Yeah. Well, it's just because that's...
He was the first person who I presented my Moon Theory to, actually.
Oh, really? Well, you know, that's the main point of, his work, is pointing out that the way that tends to be looked at in the psychological community is really unfortunate, that they categorize looking at synchronicity as a mental illness, yeah. which yeah. is absurd, because, I mean, basically, if you reach a certain point of personalization when it comes to synchronicity, like, there's a line of objectivity that can get crossed, and that's good to be aware of, and I think that there's actually a legitimate... thing there to acknowledge that, you know, where's there's lines, you know, and a lot of them might be in the sand, but there's lines that you can cross that start to verge on what could be called a mental illness.
I think Mark said to me once that that line involves thinking like that you have to modify your actions according to like these things, like if you suddenly start feeling that you need to do something or being told to do something, then
yeah, if you're giving up your free will, which is one of right. my points about determinism, that I feel is crucial, because you can talk about things influencing, but do they mean that you, like, you still have options, like, because mm-hmm. you can show that you have options, you know, I mean, even if you're being influenced, you can recognize that there's a choice in the matter. There's a propensity towards something, but that doesn't necessarily indicate necessity. So, yeah, I mean, like, Amy, you know, is a psychologist, and it will come up, you know, because I'll be following these things. This relates to this, relates to this. And she's into it and she's open. But when I start, like, I tripped out when I was watching the Rosemary's Baby sync. When it, you know, when I aligned Rosemary's Baby with the White Album, and she
brilliant.
She gets
brilliant,
and then she gets you know, impregnated, and the very next scene it's just like boom comes in with you know, it's your birthday, and I'm like, that's fucked up, because my birthday is the day that John Lennon was killed, and it just tripped me the hell out. And so that's
your birthday is December the 8th.
Yeah. And so,
oh, my, yeah, that's interesting. My sister has a birthday on that day as well.
Oh, really? Nice.
Yeah.
So anyways, it's just this crazy thing where I cannot not acknowledge that that's getting to a personal level.
Oh, yeah.
And where do I go with that? Then so the best I can do is just remain objective and acknowledge it, but then just continue on and be like, okay, not to get hung up. My mom's only advice for LSD when I was growing up was, go, okay, well, it looks like you're going to trip. Just don't trip on your trips. That was the only advice she ever gave me.
Oh, yeah. We see, you mentioned that objective line, which I basically live on the other side of 24/7. So,
right.
I mean, I'm way out there, and I'm always in my psychiatrist's face about it. And of course what I wanted to point out to you guys was that this time, which happened the same day that you asked me to join you today, David, I got through. He was very, very upset by the time our session ended this last time. And I think I know why it was, because I was talking about a television commercial that's up here in Canada. One of the major telecom companies up here is called Rogers Communication. And Rogers has a commercial where the first line, it's about how technology is helping link people together. And of course, it's young people. It's a group of young people sitting in a Starbucks talking about how cool they are in relationship to their new Wi-Fi. And the first thing that the guy says in it, he holds up his right hand as if it's a telephone and goes, maybe there'll be a chip in my hand. And I'm just like, okay, you know, if it's at this level now where it's this blatant, right, it needs to be, I think, acknowledged on the most, even on the most logical level. They're talking about putting chips in people's hands. They're selling these ideas to kids, okay? It's true, this stuff that we're talking about. It's not delusional. It's not even remotely delusional. It's just fucking horrifying. And I don't know what it was, but it was just the way that I said it to him that time. And I saw he turned very red, and he became very short with me, and he wanted to end our session immediately. And I think he was thinking about his kids, honestly.
Right.
I think finally that's how I got through to it.
Well, if you hit a personal level, see, that's the thing. If it becomes personal, that's the point at which people get triggered.
Yeah. Well, that's what you got to do, right?
Certain
but
threshold.
I actually kind of feel bad about it. You know, well, I've been seeing him for 13 years.
Yeah.
13 years. I've probably spent about 120 or 130 hours with him talking. And that's the first time I've ever gotten through to him. And it was just after our last discussion or realizing I'd be on the show again for the first time in a long time. So I think that's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
He listens to some of what I do on Always Record, but he just stops listening after a little while because for the exact same reason he kind of tunes me out, I guess. But I wanted to say one more thing because we're going to wrap it up here, I guess.
Yes.
But we were talking earlier about the whole the bee symbology, the hexagonal, the black and yellow.
Sure.
And you also mentioned the drone, right? Well, and the insect invasion by way of drones. You guys have seen the recent, or maybe you haven't, but I highly recommend it. Not After Earth. God, that was terrible. No, Oblivion with Tom Cruise.
Oh, I love that movie.
Oh, yeah. It's a really good film. It's basically a takeoff on Moon and also 2001. They kind of mix those two things together, which is already mixed together in its own way. But so you have all these hundreds of thousands of Tom Cruises who are drones, right? He can't have sex with anybody. He's a drone. Well, he's also a doctor. He's a Doctor One, D-R-O-N-E. It's a $1 bill, right? So in a sense, on the economic level, Doctor One or Doctor Bill, Doctor the Bill, the $1 bill, which is the symbol of everything American, represents these drones flooding the world, essentially, turning the world into a hexagonal, which is a non-spherical manifestation of reality. So I think it's pretty cool.
Totally.
Dr. Bill.
Oh, shit. Yeah, I like that, though. There's the wallet is the first line. Hey, have you seen my wallet? And then he's Dr. Bill. That's pretty perfect. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to close with another recommendation that you watch My Eyes Wide Shut and the wall sync up as soon as you can. It's not going to take long before you're completely hooked all the way to the end. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and as I said, just start it when the Warner Brothers placard fades out. To close up the evening, or our discussion, rather, it's only 3 o'clock. It's like evening to me. Yeah. Because it's about bedtime for this cowgirl. Uh-huh. Anyway, cowgirl. Time for the Lonesome Trail. So, the lyrics of In the Flesh, which introduce Dr. Bill and Alice going to the ball, the opening lyrics are this. So you thought you'd like to go to the show. Feel that warm thrill of confusion, that space cadet glow. Well, I've got some bad news for you, sunshine. This is not what you expected to see. If you want to find out what's behind these cold eyes, you'll just have to claw your way through this disguise. That is a message from Stanley Kubrick to his audience. And that is the very basis of the reason why Eyes Wide Shut among his fans is the least liked. And when I say his fans, I mean fanboys, is the least liked of all of his films. Right.
I never understood why, but
that's right. You know, this is exactly the point. When I came out of watching Eyes Wide Shut the first time, I was pissed off. I was angry. I'm like, what the fuck is this? I have been devoted to Stanley Kubrick against constant baloney from my other film loving friends. Oh, it's boring. You know, he has no there's nothing there. It's just whatever. The most of them had to say was, you know, any of them, it's too metaphysical, which is which is the conclusion that Pauline Kael, the great filmmaker, came to, or great film critic, came to about Kubrick. Ultimately, it's just metaphysics. Bullshit. This is flesh and blood stuff. This is a demon staring back at you and daring you to challenge him. And
she had him pegged.
Oh, but she didn't. No, that's the whole point. He's not merely metaphysical. He's a son. He wants to get into your fucking head and kick you in the ass.
Well, he is a demon.
What's that?
He is kind of a demon, though.
He is demonic, yes, but I don't consider demonic to be necessarily metaphysical. To me, the word demon just means to demonstrate, right? But yeah, so this is how I see Stanley Kubrick, to kind of close up our conversation in regards to the tensor and everything else, is that the entire theme of the movie Eyes Wide Shut is summed up in those first few words of In the Flesh. If you want to find out what's behind it, it's all about masks.
Right.
And the reason that Kubrick, who literally had for 12 long years his fans waiting with bated breath to go to a theater and see his movie and have them their asses knocked out of the park, and he's saying to you from the first second that film opens in many different ways, you're not even looking, you don't see, you don't understand me, you know nothing about me. That is the message of Eyes Wide Shut, of Stanley Kubrick, to his audience, basically, as summed up in the lyrics of In the Flesh, which the sink of which with Eyes Wide Shut is going to open up doorways you might not wish you'd ever gone down. Tennis, anyone? Yes. You know, the tennis thing. I'll leave you guys with it. This is it. I got to go. Okay. I've been, you know, the title Eyes Wide Shut is very interesting. The words set, the word set, S-E-T, ends the three words Eyes Wide Shut, S-E-T, right? And of course, on the title, those are the right-hand pillar of the title. And then after the first image of the movie, there's tennis rackets on the left-hand pillar. So I think there's something to that. Maybe somebody can crack that code open a little bit further than I do. But there's definitely something about a set, right? Set in tennis, game set and match, that sort of thing. So anyhow. I said my piece, guys.
Yeah, thank you, man. Another great show. You.
Thank you, as always.
And thank you, everybody, for being here. This is a great conversation, great morning.
Thanks for having me. It was a real pleasure. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, and I'm sorry I didn't contribute too much today, but
that's okay, John. I
absorbed a lot of it. And I
hope we get to talk again.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So
yeah, 8-10 months from now.
No. I want to have you on sooner than that.
Well, you know, I actually feel like that we should. I mean, you guys all live well. At least you do, David, and Alex as well, in the Pacific Northwest. That's not very far from where I live. I'm tempted to drive to rent a car, come live with you guys for a month, and we'll just watch Mad Men, and we'll go into it so deeply. We'll MTK Mystery Science Theater the whole thing, and have it all on tape, and then we can release it one episode at a time or something like that. I think that'd be a fun idea. It'd probably take about a month because the details would be so in depth, but. It's something to look forward to. I'd love to meet you guys in person someday and see you. But in the meantime, it's time for some hard liquor and some soft porn.
Gainsbourg et son Gainsborough ont pris le ferryboat. De leur lit, par le hublot, ils regardent la côte. Ils s'aiment et la traversée durera toute une année. Ils vaincront les maléfices jusqu'en 70.
69 années érotiques. 69 années érotiques.
Gainsbourg et son Gainsborough vont rejoindre Paris. Ils ont laissé derrière eux la Tamise et Chelsea. Ils s'aiment et la traversée durera toute une année. Et que les dieux les bénissent jusqu'en 70.
69 années érotiques. 69 années érotiques.
Ils s'aiment et la traversée durera toute une année. Il pardonnera ses caprices jusqu'en 70.
69